This is the listening paper of the year 2014 National Examination in English. There are five tasks in the paper. You will hear the first task only once, and all the other tasks twice. Turn to task one. Task one. You are going to hear a talk about expeditions to the South Pole. You will hear the talk only once. Before you listen, read the sentences below. While you listen, complete the sentences. Write no more than two words in each gap. An example, zero, has been done for you. You now have 30 seconds to read the sentences.
So for this week's podcast, we're looking at the rival expeditions for the Antarctic. So Richard, who got there first?
The first person to the South Pole was a Norwegian called Roald Amundsen. And he got there and back in 3 months. But obviously, the other expedition led by a British Royal Naval officer, Captain Scott, even though he died, is in many ways more famous.
So, Richard, apart from being British and apart from dying, which is rather sad, what made him become such a tragic hero?
Well, with Amundsen, he was first to the pole, and he should have got all the publicity, etc., etc. But he didn't really write a diary. He wasn't very media savvy, I think. And although poor Captain Scott died on the way back with all of his team, he wrote a diary every day. There's photographic evidence of him at the South Pole.
From when they got off the boat to get to the South Pole, what was the distance?
Well, Antarctica is a huge continent. They sailed to the nearest point of land, and from there it was 650 kilometres to the pole.
Right, so that's an astonishing journey to do even nowadays, let alone 100 years ago.
Exactly, yes.
And am I right in saying that when Scott, because he actually still got to the South Pole.
Yes.
But when he got there, he saw the Norwegian flag.
Yes, they'd arrived there a month before.
Which is a long time.
And then they had to trudge the 650 kilometres back to their base.
Knowing that they had failed.
Exactly.
So how come Amundsen was so successful then, Richard?
Well, he had just one aim. He wanted to reach the pole. Very simple, very well organised. 4 sledges, 52 dogs. He was an experienced dog handler.
And whereas Scott?
As well as dogs, they got ponies. Unfortunately, I think they were Siberian ponies. They weren't very good. He also had motorised transport. That didn't work. It was too cold. He wasn't an experienced dog handler. And the clothes were wrong. He had woolen sweaters. Whereas Amundsen went with, I think, seal skins. Much better adapted.
So, a tragic story.
Yes.
But brought to life by the diary and by the letters.
And it did show exactly the bravery of Scott and his team. Although they made lots of mistakes, you can't say that they weren't extremely brave.
To head off to that wilderness and to those intense low temperatures, not really equipped. I mean, foolhardy, but yes, certainly brave.
This is the end of task one. Turn to task two. Task two. You are going to hear people express their opinion on education in the United States. You will hear the recording twice. Before you listen, read the statements below. While you listen, match the statements B to G to the speakers and write letters B to G in the table given. There is one extra statement you do not need to use. An example, zero, has been done for you. You now have 30 seconds to read the statements. Example zero.
Well, from a long-term perspective, I think the comments about education are right on. But from a shorter-term perspective, nationally, we've got to understand that government has gotten too big. We've taken on the welfare of all mankind as a practical objective, and it's just not.
Speaker one.
We've lost the American competitive spirit. If you look at how we're raising our kids today and the culture that we are creating, we are spending so much time trying to make children feel good about themselves that we've lost sight of putting the time in that it takes to actually make them good at something. So, you know, I have two little girls. They play soccer. They suck at soccer. They really do.
Speaker two.
We need to do something now about people who don't have jobs now. Employers say that they have millions of jobs and that there's a skills mismatch and our people cannot fill those jobs. I am saying that some of those employers ought to get up off the cash they have and hire some people and train them on the job for some of those jobs. And we need to do something now.
Speaker three.
We have what is widely admired as the best higher education system in the world. At the same time, we have a K-12 system which is failing far too many of our younger people, especially those in poorer neighborhoods who are simply not getting the education that they need to get the jobs that will enable them to live the American lifestyle.
Speaker four.
I fully agree that a lot of this does come back to the family. However, the cost of higher education has outpaced the cost of living exponentially the last several years. When you graduate $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 in debt, which so many of my friends have, you are compelled to take the highest paying job possible. So where do they go? They go to Wall Street. And that is sucking entrepreneurship dry in this country.
Speaker 5.
The most popular engineering course in the major colleges in America is not civil engineering, it's not electrical engineering, it's not mechanical engineering, it's not aeronautical engineering, it's financial engineering, which is an attempt to beat the other guy at a game in which you ultimately, together, lose. That makes no sense.
Listen again and check your answers. Speaker 1.
We've lost the American competitive spirit. If you look at how we're raising our kids today and the culture that we are creating, we are spending so much time trying to make children feel good about themselves that we've lost sight of putting the time in that it takes to actually make them good at something. So, you know, I have two little girls. They play soccer. They suck at soccer. They really do.
Speaker two.
We need to do something now about people who don't have jobs now. Employers say that they have millions of jobs and that there's a skills mismatch and our people cannot fill those jobs. I am saying that some of those employers ought to get up off the cash they have and hire some people and train them on the job for some of those jobs. And we need to do something now.
Speaker 3.
We have what is widely admired as the best higher education system in the world. At the same time, we have a K-12 system which is failing far too many of our younger people, especially those in poorer neighborhoods who are simply not getting the education that they need to get the jobs that will enable them to live the American lifestyle.
Speaker 4.
I fully agree that a lot of this does come back to the family. However, the cost of higher education has outpaced the cost of living exponentially the last several years. When you graduate $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 in debt, which so many of my friends have, you are compelled to take the highest paying job possible. So where do they go? They go to Wall Street. And that is sucking entrepreneurship dry in this country.
Speaker 5.
The most popular engineering course in the major colleges in America is not civil engineering, it's not electrical engineering, it's not mechanical engineering, it's not aeronautical engineering, it's financial engineering, which is an attempt to beat the other guy at a game in which you ultimately, together, lose. That makes no sense.
This is the end of Task 2. Turn to Task 3. Task 3. You are going to hear a talk about Disneyland. You will hear the talk twice. Before you listen, read the sentences below. While you listen, complete the sentences. Write no more than 3 words in each gap. An example, 0 has been done for you. You now have 30 seconds to read the sentences.
In 1951, Disney had an idea for a park to give families something to do together in Southern California. His first plan was to make a park in Burbank, across the street from the Disney Studios.
And on December 16th of 1952, Walt Disney Incorporated was founded by Disney to build the park. So it went through a few name changes, but it originally started in 1952 to build Disneyland. And that new company was actually staffed up with a lot of the artists and the visionaries from Walt's movie studio, even though they had not worked on a theme park before. And that hire to bring in movie industry people and animators may seem odd when you think about it, but Walt's whole idea was that they were going to be telling stories in 3 dimensions instead of 2. And since story was always going to be the focus, professional storytellers to him seemed like the exact right people for these jobs.
These ideas quickly became way too big for the 11-acre plot of land that he initially had in mind. So the focus shifted to Los Angeles. In 1953, Walt hired the Stanford Research Institute to survey Los Angeles and the surrounding area for a 100-acre site that would be suitable for what he and the WED team had in mind. And that's how they found Disneyland's home. It was a 160-acre orange grove in Anaheim, and this location met all of Walt's requirements. It had to be freeway accessible, adjacent to or within Los Angeles, and affordable.
Yeah, and nowadays the Disney company is huge, that is so huge that it's really hard for most people, and even me, to think about it ever having shallow pockets. But at the time, it was a very different story. Walt was really struggling to figure out how he was going to finance this huge vision of his and to build a theme park. And it actually led to the genesis of the television series Walt Disney's Disneyland. That show came out of the need for funding, and Walt struck a deal with ABC in 1954 that he would host for them this hour-long weekly series, which was about Disneyland and also about sort of, exploration of concepts in society and technology and storytelling. And in exchange for him hosting this, ABC was funding the construction of the theme park project.
So once the funding and location were secured, construction started and went on at a really breakneck pace. They broke ground on July 21st, 1954, and just a year later, on July 15th, 1955, Disneyland opened to the public. It cost an estimated $17 million to build.
It sounds like a lot, but I think nowadays, if a similar project were built, it would be in the billions and billions.
Yeah, that was $17,000,000 1955.
Yeah, so it was a lot of money. There was so much anticipation leading up to the opening of the park, and so many people were so excited at this thought of an entire park devoted to this concept of, you know, storytelling and animation, that they were even using counterfeit tickets to get in. The park was overcrowded, way past probably what was a smart capacity. the temperature was a problem. They were in the middle of a heat wave in California, and it was 110 degrees Fahrenheit. And there was fresh asphalt that had been poured as late as the night before the park opened, and it hadn't all cured properly because of the heat conditions. And so there are stories of people's shoes sinking into the asphalt. But even though it was a bumpy opening day, the problems got ironed out and things picked up, and pretty quickly the park became really, really popular.
Listen again and check your answers.
In 1951, Disney had an idea for a park to give families something to do to get together in Southern California. His first plan was to make a park in Burbank, across the street from the Disney Studios.
And on December 16th of 1952, Walt Disney Incorporated was founded by Disney to build the park. So it went through a few name changes, but it originally started in 1952 to build Disneyland. And that new company was actually staffed up with a lot of the artists and the visionaries from Walt's movie studio, even though they had not worked on a theme park before. And that hire to bring in movie industry people and animators may seem odd when you think about it, but Walt's whole idea was that they were going to be telling stories in three dimensions instead of two. And since story was always going to be the focus, professional storytellers to him seemed like the exact right people for these jobs.
These ideas quickly became way too big for the 11-acre plot of land that he initially had in mind. So the focus shifted to Los Angeles. In 1953, Walt hired the Stanford Research Institute to survey Los Angeles and the surrounding area for a 100-acre site that would be suitable for what he and the WED team had in mind. And that's how they found Disneyland's home. It was a 160-acre orange grove in Anaheim, and this location met all of Walt's requirements. It had to be freeway accessible, adjacent to or within Los Angeles, and affordable.
Yeah, and you know, nowadays the Disney company is so huge that it's really hard for most people, and even me, to think about it ever having shallow pockets. But at the time, it was a very different story. You know, Walt was really struggling to figure out how he was going to finance this huge vision of his and to build a theme park. And it actually led to the genesis of the television series Walt Disney's Disneyland. That show came out of the need for funding, and Walt struck a deal with ABC in 1954 that he would host for them this hour-long weekly series, which was about Disneyland and also about sort of, you know, exploration of concepts in society and technology and storytelling. And in exchange for him hosting this, ABC was funding the construction of the theme park project.
So once the funding and location were secured, construction started and went on at a really breakneck pace. They broke ground on July 21st, 1954, and just a year later, on July 15th, 1955, Disneyland opened to the public. It cost an estimated $17 million to build.
It sounds like a lot, but I think nowadays, if a similar project were built, it would be in the billions and billions.
Yeah, that was $17,000,955.
Yeah, so it was a lot of money. There was so much anticipation leading up to the opening of the park, and so many people were so excited at this thought of an entire park devoted to this concept of, you know, storytelling and animation, that they were even using counterfeit tickets to get in. The park was overcrowded, way past probably what was a smart capacity. The temperature was a problem. They were in the middle of a heat wave in California, and it was 110 degrees Fahrenheit. And there was fresh asphalt that had been poured as late as the night before the park opened, and it hadn't all cured properly because of the heat conditions. And so there are stories of people's shoes sinking into the asphalt. But even though it was a bumpy opening day, the problems got ironed out and things picked up, and pretty quickly the park became really, really popular.
This is the end of task 3. Turn to task 4. Task 4. You are going to hear different news items. You will hear the recording twice. Before you listen, read the headlines below. While you listen, match the headlines B to L to the news items and write letters B to L in the table given. there are two extra headlines you do not need to use. An example zero has been done for you. You now have 30 seconds to read the headlines. Item zero.
Russia's government will remove a large building in the center of Moscow. The building looks exactly like a brown Louis Vuitton suitcase. The luxury goods maker built it for a 6-week exhibition of Louis Vuitton luggage.
Item 24.
Help may soon be at hand or head for the millions around the world who suffer from and worry about baldness. Scientists from the University of Durham in the UK say they are close to finding a solution to grow new hair. Unlike transplants, the new procedure will allow the hair to keep growing naturally in the follicle.
Item 25.
Microsoft's new games console, the Xbox One, sold more than 1 million consoles within 24 hours of its release. Many people waited outside stores overnight to buy it. Many Xbox One customers were disappointed after buying the console. They saw error messages soon after they switched the machine on and uploaded an update.
Item 26.
A major road safety campaign is underway in Britain to get hands-free mobile phones banned. The charity Brake is also calling for motorists to switch off their phones while driving. The group said the fines for calling or texting while behind the wheel should also be increased by up to tenfold, to around $1,600.
Item 27.
Samsung has entered the newly emerging smartwatch market by unveiling its multifunction timepiece, the Galaxy Gear. It is a digital watch with a difference. Wearers can make telephone calls, receive emails, and take photographs. It can also run dozens of Android apps on its 1.6-inch screen. Users navigate through different screens and functions using swipes.
Item 28.
Samoa Air has discarded the traditional pricing model of asking flyers to pay for a seat and instead has moved to a price per kilogram structure. The airline flies domestically between the country's two main islands. Travelers pay a price of around $1 per kilogram on shorter routes and over $4 on longer flights.
Item 29.
A study from the UK indicates that people who post too many selfies, photos of themselves, on Facebook and similar social networks risk damaging their real-life relationships. The report analysed the impact of these photos on the relationships of 508 participants. The study found that excessive photo sharing and sharing certain types of photos makes almost everyone like you less.
Item 30.
The search engine giant Google has started a new app that lets people give just $1 to different charities. It's One Today app shows users a variety of charities every day. The homepage says, open the app and you're presented with several projects to which you can donate $1 with one click. It's that simple, and most people can afford the occasional $1 donation.
Item 31.
Officials at the Death Valley National Park have appealed to visitors to refrain from trying to fry eggs on rocks or the ground. The park has been inundated with visitors trying to test the theory that it is hot enough to fry an egg ever since a park employee posted a video on YouTube of her attempt to do so. The online clip, together with soaring temperatures nearing 50 degrees Celsius, encouraged many people to try their own experiment, with messy results.
Listen again and check your answers. Item 24.
Help may soon be at hand or head for the millions around the world who suffer from and worry about baldness. Scientists from the University of Durham in the UK say they are close to finding a solution to grow new hair. Unlike transplants, the new procedure will allow the hair to keep growing naturally in the follicle.
Item 25.
Microsoft's new games console, the Xbox One, sold more than 1 million consoles within 24 hours of its release. Many people waited outside stores overnight to buy it. Many Xbox One customers were disappointed after buying the console. They saw error messages soon after they switched the machine on and uploaded an update.
Item 26.
A major road safety campaign is underway in Britain to get hands-free mobile phones banned. The charity Brake is also calling for motorists to switch off their phones while driving. The group said the fines for calling or texting while behind the wheel should also be increased by up to tenfold, to around $1,600.
Item 27.
Samsung has entered the newly emerging smartwatch market by unveiling its multifunction timepiece, the Galaxy Gear. It is a digital watch with a difference. Wearers can make telephone calls, receive emails, and take photographs. It can also run dozens of Android apps on its 1.6-inch screen. Users navigate through different screens and functions using swipes.
Item 28.
Samoa Air has discarded the traditional pricing model of asking flyers to pay for a seat and instead has moved to a price per kilogram structure. The airline flies domestically between the country's two main islands. Travelers pay a price of around $1 per kilogram on shorter routes and over $4 on longer flights.
Item 29.
A study from the UK indicates that people who post too many selfies, photos of themselves, on Facebook and similar social networks risk damaging their real-life relationships. The report analysed the impact of these photos on the relationships of 508 participants. The study found that excessive photo sharing and sharing certain types of photos makes almost everyone like you less.
Item 30.
The search engine giant Google has started a new app that lets people give just $1 to different charities. Its One Today app shows users a variety of charities every day. The homepage says, "Open the app and you're presented with several projects to which you can donate $1 with one click." It's that simple, and most people can afford the occasional $1 donation.
Item 31.
Officials at the Death Valley National Park have appealed to visitors to refrain from trying to fry eggs on rocks or the ground. The park has been inundated with visitors trying to test the theory that it is hot enough to fry an egg ever since a park employee posted a video on YouTube of her attempt to do so. The online clip, together with soaring temperatures nearing 50 degrees Celsius, encouraged many people to try their own experiment, with messy results.
This is the end of Task 4. Turn to Task 5. Task 5. You are going to hear a talk about waste management. You will hear the talk twice. Before you listen, read the sentences below. While you listen, tick the correct answer A, B, or C. An example, 0, has been done for you. You now have 45 seconds to read the sentences.
I was about 10 years old on a camping trip with my dad in the Adirondack Mountains. We got to our campsite. It was a lean-to on a bluff looking over a crystal beautiful lake when I discovered a horror. Behind the lean-to was a dump, maybe 40 feet square with rotting apple cores and balled up aluminum foil and a dead sneaker. And I was astonished and I was deeply confused. The campers who were too lazy to take out what they had brought in, who did they think would clean up after them? That question stayed with me, and it simplified a little. Who cleans up after us? Here in New York, the Department of Sanitation cleans up after us, to the tune of 11,000 tons of garbage and 2,000 tons of recyclables every day. I wanted to get to know them as individuals. I wanted to understand who takes the job, what's it like to wear the uniform and bear that burden. So I took the job as a sanitation worker, and I operated the mechanical brooms, and I plowed the snow. It was a remarkable privilege and an amazing education. Everyone asks about the smell. It's there, but it's not as prevalent as you think. And on days when it is really bad, you get used to it rather quickly. The weight takes a long time to get used to. I knew people who were several years on the job whose bodies were still adjusting to the burden of bearing on your body tons of trash every week. Then there's the danger. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, sanitation work is one of the 10 most dangerous occupations in the country. And I learned why. You're in and out of traffic all day, and it's zooming around you. It just wants to get past you. So it's often the motorist is not paying attention. That's really bad for the worker. And then the garbage itself is full of hazards that often fly back out of the truck and do terrible harm. And then there's the stigma. You put on the uniform, and you become invisible until someone is upset with you for whatever reason, like you've blocked traffic with your truck, or you're taking a break too close to their home, or you're drinking coffee in their diner, and they will come and scorn you. I find the stigma especially ironic because I strongly believe that sanitation workers are the most important labor force on the streets of the city for three reasons. They are the first guardians of public health. If they're not taking away trash, it starts to spill out of its containments, and the dangers inherent to it threaten us in very real ways. Diseases we've had in check for decades and centuries burst forth again and start to harm us. The economy needs them. If we can't throw out the old stuff, we have no room for the new stuff. So then the engines of the economy start to sputter when consumption is compromised. I'm not advocating capitalism. I'm just pointing out the relationship. And then there's what I call our average necessary quotidian velocity. By that, I simply mean how fast we're used to moving in the contemporary day and age. We usually don't care for, repair, clean, carry around our coffee cup, our shopping bag, our bottle of water. We use them, we throw them out, we forget about them because we know there's a workforce on the other side that's going to take it all away. On the day after September 11th in 2001, I heard the growl of a sanitation truck on the street, and I grabbed my infant son and I ran downstairs, and there was a man doing his paper recycling route like he did every Wednesday. And I tried to thank him for doing his work on that day of all days, but I started to cry. And he looked at me and he just nodded and he said, "We're gonna be okay." It's a little while later that I started my research with sanitation and I met that man again. His name was Paulie, and we worked together many times. I want to believe that Paulie was right. We are going to be okay. But in our effort to reconfigure how we as a species exist on this planet, we must include and take account of all the costs, including the very real human cost of the labor. And we also would be well informed to reach out to the people who do that work and get their expertise on how do we think about, how do we create systems around sustainability that perhaps takes us from curbside recycling and lift us up to a broader horizon where we're looking at other forms of waste that could be lessened from manufacturing and industrial sources. Municipal waste, what we think of when we talk about garbage, accounts for 3% of the nation's waste stream. It's a remarkable statistic. So in the flow of your days, next time you see someone whose job is to clean up after you, take a moment to acknowledge them.
Listen again and check your answers.
I was about 10 years old on a camping trip with my dad in the Adirondack Mountains. We got to our campsite. It was a lean-to on a bluff looking over a crystal beautiful lake when I discovered a horror. Behind the lean-to was a dump, maybe 40 feet square with rotting apple cores and balled up aluminum foil and a dead sneaker. And I was astonished and I was deeply confused. The campers who were too lazy to take out what they had brought in, who did they think would clean up after them? That question stayed with me, and it simplified a little. Who cleans up after us? Here in New York, the Department of Sanitation cleans up after us, to the tune of 11,000 tons of garbage and 2,000 tons of recyclables every day. I wanted to get to know them as individuals. I wanted to understand who takes the job, what's it like to wear the uniform and bear that burden. So I took the job as a sanitation worker, and I operated the mechanical brooms, and I plowed the snow. It was a remarkable privilege and an amazing education. Everyone asks about the smell. It's there, but it's not as prevalent as you think, and on days when it is really bad, you get used to it rather quickly. The weight takes a long time to get used to. I knew people who were several years on the job whose bodies were still adjusting to the burden of bearing on your body tons of trash every week. Then there's the danger. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, sanitation work is one of the 10 most dangerous occupations in the country. And I learned why. You're in and out of traffic all day, and it's zooming around you. It just wants to get past you. So it's often the motorist is not paying attention. That's really bad for the worker. And then the garbage itself is full of hazards that often fly back out of the truck and do terrible harm. And then there's the stigma. You put on the uniform, and you become invisible until someone is upset with you for whatever reason, like you've blocked traffic with your truck, or you're taking a break too close to their home, or you're drinking coffee in their diner, and they will come and scorn you. I find the stigma especially ironic because I strongly believe that sanitation workers are the most important labor force on the streets of the city for three reasons. They are the first guardians of public health. If they're not taking away trash, it starts to spill out of its containments, and the dangers inherent to it threaten us in very real ways. Diseases we've had in check for decades and centuries burst forth again and start to harm us. The economy needs them. If we can't throw out the old stuff, we have no room for the new stuff. So then the engines of the economy start to sputter when consumption is compromised. I'm not advocating capitalism. I'm just pointing out the relationship. And then there's what I call our average necessary quotidian velocity. By that, I simply mean how fast we're used to moving in the contemporary day and age. We usually don't care for, repair, clean, carry around our coffee cup, our shopping bag, our bottle of water. We use them, we throw them out, we forget about them because we know there's a workforce on the other side that's going to take it all away. On the day after September 11th in 2001, I heard the growl of a sanitation truck on the street, and I grabbed my infant son and I ran downstairs, and there was a man doing his paper recycling route like he did every Wednesday. And I tried to thank him for doing his work on that day of all days, but I started to cry. And he looked at me and he just nodded and he said, "We're gonna be okay." It's a little while later that I started my research with sanitation and I met that man again. His name was Paulie, and we worked together many times. I want to believe that Paulie was right. We are going to be okay. But in our effort to reconfigure how we as a species exist on this planet, we must include and take account of all the costs, including the very real human cost of the labor. And we also would be well informed to reach out to the people who do that work and get their expertise on how do we think about, how do we create systems around sustainability that perhaps takes us from curbside recycling and lift us up to a broader horizon where we're looking at other forms of waste that could be lessened from manufacturing and industrial sources. Municipal waste, what we think of when we talk about garbage, accounts for 3% of the nation's waste stream. It's a remarkable statistic. So, in the flow of your days, next time you see someone whose job is to clean up after you, take a moment to acknowledge them.
This is the end of the listening paper. Now turn to the reading paper.